ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is The Bookshelf, which means if you're looking for a good book, then you are in the right place, because this is where each week we review fresh new fiction from Australia and around the world. And usually I'd be saying g'day to Kate Evans, but today Jonathan Green, the presenter of Every Bright, is here.
That Jonathan. Must have been a shock.
No, lovely to be with you, Jonathan. Are you ready to pass judgment?
Well yes. I think, given the text before us, there may be judgments, but in the nicest possible way, Cassie.
Well, you have chosen a good ep to drop by because we have some real beauties on our way, including the latest from the UK literary giant Jeanette Winterson, One Aladdin, Two Lamps, which recounts, I understand, the Arabian Nights, part fiction, part memoir.
Yeah, it is a real hybrid of a book. And it's a full-throated, and this is central to our conversation, it's a full-throated defence of the possibilities of fiction and of story. New Zealand critic Claire Mabey will join us from across the Dutch to discuss Jeanette Winterson. Also, The Silver Book by Olivia Lang. A noir thriller, or is it? It takes us behind the scenes of the cool Italian cinema world of the 1970s.
Yes, where things and people are not what they seem. Associate Professor Hugh Griffiths is reviewing that with us. But first, Jonathan, let's head into the brilliant, idiosyncratic mind of one of America's literary giants, Thomas Pynchon, and his first novel in 12 years. Thomas Pynchon is 88 years old and he was born in 1937. Before we do anything else, Jonathan, discuss the pronunciation of his name. I think we've got to get this off our chests.
I've always gone Pynchon.
Pynchon.
Am I wrong?
Well, look, he's famously incredibly reclusive. He doesn't do interviews. There's only sort of a few photos of him around when he was very young.
Most of which were taken when he was about 22. So.
Yes, and he has these very prominent teeth, which apparently he was horrified by, reportedly. Anyway.
Don't you have great respect for that, though, someone who just keeps doing great work but cares nothing for the trappings?
But there is this sort of mystery about him as a real person.
Yeah, and his novels themselves are mysterious. They're famous for being densely packed with ideas and cultural reference. I well remember, Cassie, the decade that took me to plough through Gravity's Rainbow.
You are better than me, because I didn't make it. I promised I would read it, and I got halfway through. But it was brilliant. I mean, I regret not finishing it, because what I read, I loved.
I think it's a book I should have come to a bit later than when I started it, but there are so many of those. V is another one, 1963. The Crying of Lot 49 in 1966. And yes, my dear friend, Gravity's Rainbow. Mm-hmm. That won the 1974 US National Book Award for Fiction. We've had, well, more recent things. 2009 was Inherent Vice, Bleeding Edge in 2013, and now. Mm-hmm. All those years after, we have Shadow Ticket.
Back to the pronunciation of his name. Because he is such a recluse, it's not exactly known, but he has made two appearances in voice only on The Simpsons.
Of course.
The world's most powerful cultural object, it could be argued. And he's drawn with a bag on his head, a paper bag, so we don't have any updates on what he looks like. But here he is, reportedly, his voice pronouncing his name.
Here's your quote. Thomas Pynchon loved this book almost as much as he loves cameras. Hey, over here, have your picture taken with a reclusive author. Today only, we'll throw in a free autograph. But wait, there's more.
He's a funny man.
He is a funny man.
All right, so Thomas Pynchon. The other thing I really like, there's a story apparently, Laurie Anderson asked him for permission to adapt Gravity's Rainbow into an opera, as
of course
perhaps you would. He says, sure. The opera had been scored for solo banjo. that is a Pynchon-esque gesture.
Yeah. Sure, go for it, kid.
With a banjo.
One banjo is all you get.
He is a very funny man.
Yes, he is. And that brings us to Shadow Ticket.
Shadow Ticket.
So this is the third that he's done in that style of the private eye. Inherent Vice was one. The other one, Bleeding Edge, was one too. But this one is set in the 1930s.
1932, to be precise. Mm.
So, you know, the good, although temperate, 20s are over and the dark era of the Depression is underway, and we are in Milwaukee.
We have a private detective. Times are hard, and our hero, Hicks McTaggart, he's a private eye. He has a roaming eye when it comes to the ladies, but it's reciprocated. He is a very good swing dancer, as well as being, in his former life, a head-busting anti-union thug. I mean, he loves his Milwaukee. He's a bit phobic of the outside world. Even Chicago feels like a trip too far for Hicks. However, the world is closing in a little on him. The opening of this book, I mean, it feels, I was lulled into a false sense of security. It feels incredibly familiar. It's Gumshoe Noir. It's 1932. Prohibition's winding down. Al Capone is in the clink. Our hero, however, his future has more to do with the Al Capone of cheese. that is a sign of a very Pynchon-esque flight of hilarious fantasy there. And a scene in which the Al Capone of cheese, local dairy magnate Bruno Ehrmost, Bruno meets Al Capone and asks the mobster, "What are you the Al Capone of?" Which is such a great moment.
So, I mean, I kind of thought, is this actually a spoof of the private detective
of
novels?
The genre.
You know, like, is he just taking the proverbial?
This is what Pynchon does. He takes that base strand, this sort of foundational idea of that trope, right? And then embellishes that with this hyper-reality, this mystical, magical, hilarious, sardonic, sarcastic, revelatory, postmodern pastiche. It's this elevation above that sort of commonly understood thing that becomes something wild and different. And that just takes so much skill. And this book is a spectacle of that skill. He is amazing the way he can just add to what is familiar to make it something just outrageous, astounding, hilarious, complicated, digressive, complex, but with this sort of accomplished lightness of touch.
You're absolutely right. I agree with you in every way. There's just these sort of strings of words that get thrown together and you think, my God, that is so funny.
Sentence by sentence, this is a staggering book.
Yeah. Yeah, which is actually the only way you can intake this information because it is so out there. But, you know, he says, well, you being a wise guy, or, well, in your case, otherwise. You know, in any other book, that would be a
so
standout.
Nice.
And it's just,
but it's just a line.
Just one.
So to take us back to the Al Capone of cheese, because this is a very important character. Well, more important, his daughter.
Well, actually, just before we do, before we even met Al Capone of cheese or his daughter, I was already conscious that there was this big dairy theme sort of flowing through it. It was milky, and I was thinking, what's this milk about? Is this about the sort of, you know, the pure American wholesomeness of drinking a glass of milk as they seem to do at the dinner table, you know, these crazy Americans? But then when it sours to become cheese. You think, is there
episode
else
24
going on?
In which Cassie reads too much into Thomas Pynchon.
Oh, you think?
I don't know.
God, I was working up a thesis on that.
So we have, yes, the Al Capone of cheese. Bruno has a daughter, Daphne. She has a thing for Hop Wingdale, who's a clarinet player for a band called the Klezmopolitans, which is
so good.
It's also hilarious. Hicks's employer, he works for this private investigation firm called Unamalgamated Ops. Hicks's employer is hired to bring Daphne home. She's flown the coop with the Klezmopolitan. Hicks is singled out for this job, but he does not want a bar of this because it would involve A, leaving Milwaukee, and B, potentially too close a relationship with the Al Capone of cheese. But his circumstances are conspiring. The mafia, the feds, they're both putting on pressure. After the local Milwaukee bombing, Hicks is in an increasingly narrowing frame. You may be getting the impression that this is a book that's fairly dense with conflicting strands of narrative. That impression is correct.
That is, and it seems entirely intentional. And people walk in and on stage and then off stage with sort of blinding speed as well.
But potentially never to be seen again.
Yes.
But they're existing for that perfect moment in this exquisitely realised miniature.
Oh, well, can we just for a moment talk about Fancy Vivid, who is a Corrine, which of course is a chorus girl, who has this blindingly platinum cocktail bob, and she's trying to find a guy called Stuffy Keegan, who we've already met.
Yes.
Who is this nerdy guy who is pretty certain that there is a submarine in the middle of Lake Milwaukee or Michigan.
Which it turns out there is.
It actually is. And so there's this brilliant line where Hicks and Fancy Vivid meet up. He ever say anything to you about a submarine? Hick wonders. At about the same time, Fancy asks, he ever say to you anything about a submarine? And then she says, kept wanting to know if I'd ever been on one, if I'd like to go for a ride on one. At first I thought it was just some kind of sex talk.
This is the wonderful thing. So much of this book is propelled by that kind of dialogue. This the book lives 80% of its life between quote marks. And the way that Pynchon writes that sort of conversation is just so beautifully realised. He has such an ear. And this is perhaps one of the great virtues of being a semi-anonymous reclusive author, that you can wander about listening to people and not be detected, because clearly he does this because the way he writes conversation is astounding.
Yeah.
So our hero is being slowly but surely shoehorned into this pursuit of the daughter of the Al Capone of cheese, leaves his sweetheart, the lounge singer, April Radazzo, and also the sweetly boyish juvenile delinquent sidekick, Skeet Wheeler. Skeet will return in this book from this point, rather distant coda. But Skeet, and this is one of the weird things about the book, the Skeet vanishes and then is tasked with the thing of tying the whole thing up in a bow. However, that's much later. Hicks agrees to go at least to New York. And he doesn't have much choice in the matter because he's going to get locked up by the feds if he doesn't. It turns out, however, that he's just one drug drink away from an ocean liner heading east towards Daphne's trail and a steadily darkening Europe. It's a trail that'll take Hicks from Budapest to the Carpathians. And this shadow of a darker reality lengthens the rise of Nazism and the threat to its future victims. And that was funny once back in Milwaukee. Milwaukee has a big German population and a local Nazi chapter based in a Milwaukee bowling alley. These people were, by their own admission, putting the socialising into national socialism. But by book's end, the whole thing takes a darker demeanour.
Yes, and as always, there is the haunting paranoia behind what we saw in Gravity's Rainbow, although I only got halfway through, you know, of this huge political infrastructure underneath what's really happening.
See, this is the thing with this book and with Pynchon. Yes, Pynchon is still engaged in that project of trying to reveal the reality of the world to us through this play of exaggeration and sort of hyperbolic creation of this sort of hyper-reality. But in the world in which we now live, that one could argue has become Pynchon world, that the world in which we now live is so absurd How does this author's imagination fall in that reality? Is it still doing its job of showing us what is true? And I'd argue that with this book, Shadow Ticket, it starts to be simply an exercise in his demonstration of skill.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a fine thing.
I think he is singular, and that is perhaps why he is the giant that he is.
And who knows, maybe 88, this could be the last.
It could be. Well, that is the US National Book Award for Fiction winning Thomas Pynchon and his latest, Shadow Ticket. Well, let's say hello to our reviewers. With us today, Hugh Griffiths, who's Associate Professor at the University of Sydney's School of English and Writing. His research interests include 16th and 17th century English literature, as well as 20th century and contemporary British poetry and contemporary gay fiction. Hugh Griffiths, lovely to have you back.
Hello.
Also with us, Claire Mabey, founder of the New Zealand Literary Festival, Verb Wellington. She's also books editor for the independent journalism magazine, The Spin-Off, and an award-winning writer whose middle grade children's book, The Raven Eye Runaways, was published last year with a sequel out in April. Claire, thank you for joining us from New Zealand.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm particularly relieved that Claire is Verb Wellington. I'm hoping there's a mushroom component to that. But Hugh, to begin with you, you're in academia. You're in touch with the young people, Hugh, of whom we hear distressing reports about their taste or otherwise for books. What are the kids reading, Hugh?
Well, I think I meet a particular kind of young person who's elected to come and study literature at university. So I don't think they'd be that representative. But what I think we're finding is, and it's really in my mind at the moment because I was just navigating a return to teaching the first year course next year and thinking about what kind of thing I might teach. What appears to us is that students at that level, they really want to study the classics again. It's kind of interesting to know why that might be, whether they feel they're not getting it or whether it's not there in the culture so they don't know how to access it, or whether they just simply, if they come to university, they want to do what it says on the tin. They want a kind of classic university education. But that's our kind of feeling. And obviously in a university like Sydney, we can provide all sorts of things, you know, that we have a whole range of different kind of research interests in literature, really wide, very broad. And we might really want to teach them more obscure stuff. But what we find in the first year is that they really just want to study fairly classic stuff. It does speak, I think, to an affection for the analog as well. This attachment to books. So quite often in the senior course I teach, which is a Shakespeare course, I really want them to use the most up-to-date digital text that we have, you know, constantly updated, run by serious researchers, loads of footnote, everything. But no, they always ask me, Hugh, I need a book. I want you to give me a real book to hold in my hand that I can annotate, that I can scratch on, that I can scribble on, bring notes to class with. So there is that kind of idea as well, a kind of an attachment to something that slips between the cracks of the digital and that attaches itself to the physical book, which is often quite odd for people who work as researchers in the field where we're kind of trained. I mean, I barely look off a screen during the day, but they really want us to take them off that screen.
How wonderfully reassuring.
Yeah, it is great news. Does that hearten you, Claire?
Oh, so much. I love an annotated book.
Me too. Yeah.
And there must be a reassurance, Claire, as for you as a children's author. This is not a vain quest.
Exactly. And I have to say, one of the lovely things about becoming a children's author is meeting lots and lots of children who still love books and are incredibly intelligent with their reading, and they have the most brilliant questions. So I have been heartened.
What do they say? I mean, what are the sort of comments that they might make?
I think what I noticed is children have that capacity to become very enmeshed in the story. You know, they deeply care about what's happening. They love the characters. So I get a lot of questions about how did I create characters and who are my favourites. You know, they're very invested in the world. And I think adults can lose that quite quickly, but children retain the magic easily. And that is the joy of being a children's writer, is you put yourself back into that mode of thinking where the world is magical and you care very deeply about these fictional characters. So the children speak to me like it's real, and that is so much fun.
Claire, the other hat that you wear is as a reviewer and critic of books in New Zealand. What have you been reading lately?
Well, it's been a really great year for New Zealand non-fiction, actually, mm-hmm. Which has been great fun. So one of my favourites this year is Northbound by Naomi Arnold. And it's an account of walking Te Araroa, which is the trail that goes from the bottom to the top or the top to the bottom of New Zealand. And Naomi's a great journalist. Her writing is absolutely brilliant. And she walked from the bottom to the top, which is why it's Northbound. And it's her account of everything that happened along the way, the people she meet, the absolute pain she goes through, the toenails that fall off and the shoes she chews through and the mud that, you know, nearly makes her give up. And it's so immersive. I felt like I'd done the trail myself. Mm. So it's great. And the other one that I loved a lot is called Slowing the Sun by Nadine Hooter, which is about trying to understand climate change through a Te Ao Māori lens. So trying to understand the people and the land at the heart of climate impact.
And that's going to be such, I think, an important understanding that we all need to sort of walk towards a little, I think, in these coming years. That seems to be the secret.
Absolutely. It's on the one hand, incredibly logical, and on the other hand, it feels very radical.
Slowing the Sun, what a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
And of course, we always put all the books that we've mentioned on our program page so you can track that down if there's something that we talk about that you would like to track down yourself. All right, well, why don't we turn to the books that you've read for us today? Claire and Jonathan, you've read One Aladdin, Two Lamps by Jeanette Winterson.
We certainly have.
We'll get to that very soon. I can't wait to hear. But Hugh, we've read The Silver Book by Olivia Lang. So let's start with that one.
Olivia Lang, they're a British writer, novelist and critic. They've written widely on art and culture, author of five works of non-fiction and a novel, Crudo. That's an homage to Kathy Acker, the late US writer and performance artist. Now, Cassie, this new novel, The Silver Book, that's also a homage of sorts, is it not, to Italian cinema?
Yes, but that is not immediately obvious. This is how the story begins. It's in the 1970s, and there's a young man who's, we learn, an art student. He's called Nicholas, and he's fleeing London. He's just left the Tate Gallery, and he sees a newspaper headline out of the corner of his eye, and he immediately knows he has to leave London. We don't know why, but he empties his rented room and then he gets on the ferry train to Paris. While he's on the foot, he thinks of Alan's soft, sober face. So we think maybe this departure, this hasty departure, has something to do with Alan. And then this very short passage ends with the line, "It is the 17th of September, 1974. He's 22 and he has already obliterated the first of his lives."
Ooh.
Hugh, it's such an extraordinary opening. What kind of novel did you think you were reading at first?
Well, at first, I suppose it's like a kind of neo-noir novel. The atmosphere is like that train stations transition, like fleeing across Europe, this idea of a lost identity or a cancelled identity. It quickly changes, I think, as soon as we arrive in Venice and Nicholas meets the other main character, Danilo. But Nicholas, right from the start, is a really fascinating character. And we get a real clue about how we're going to follow him or how we're going to think about him right through the novel. Early on, it's the moment where he's in the station in London and he's kind of deciding, he doesn't know which city to go to on the train and the ferry. And he looks in the bathroom mirror and he describes himself. He says, "He's a good ghost, practiced at the art of invisibility, the knack of becoming an object that eyes skim over." And that seems to be true about him throughout, that people just skim over him, that he seems almost absent from his own story, endlessly adaptable to other circumstances. So when he's eventually kind of meets and falls into a relationship with Danilo, that's what Danilo likes about him as well. He calls him endlessly adaptable, incredible knack of accommodating himself to what is needed. So he's a kind of, I guess, a character who changes his skin a lot, but is maybe almost doesn't exist. He's
a cipher.
Yeah, and you see fleeting glimpses of him. So Danilo describes him dancing at one point, and it's a really striking thing because you think, oh, right, so he actually does things rather than just observe the world, because what he does when he gets to Venice, he's sketching. So he's an artist and he's just sketching on the street, one of the churches, and Danilo spots him. And it turns out that Danilo is the costume and set designer for two big film directors. He's working on Fellini's Casanova at that moment. And so he's really intrigued by this beautiful boy, as he's described, like a version of Tadzio from Death in Venice.
Yes, we already have Death in Venice in our mind, don't we? Because there we are, and here's this older man looking at this young man. And I guess if you've seen the film or read the book by Thomas Mann, you'll be thinking of that. Yeah.
Yeah. The difference is that Danilo buys him a sandwich, and the next thing we know, they're in bed together.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a kind of different novel in that way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it constantly passes the cinematic world and images from it like that. But yeah, actually, that moment where Danilo sees, well, Nico, as he ends up calling him, for the first time. It is here that Danilo sees him for the first time, crouched on the step opposite the church of San Vidal at the corner of Campo Santo Stefano. He looks like Vivaldi, the Venetian priest, with his pale skin, his flaming hair. He looks like a Renaissance angel, though obviously English. To his own displeasure, Danilo's first thought is how much Federico would love that white face. It irritates him that Federico's preferences are so deeply inscribed that he is aware of them before he can discover his own, more subterranean responses. So, Hugh, you already mentioned Danilo, who is a real person, Danilo Donati, this costume set designer, considered one of the greatest. Federico is Fellini.
Yeah. So they're working, or Danilo's working at that moment on this really kind of complex film of Fellini's, Casanova, which kind of took years to produce, was incredibly overproduced. If you watch it, you'll see the incredible sets that Donati manages to produce for that. Interestingly, of course, not produced in Venice itself, but in Rome. So he's only in Venice to find out what Venice looks like so that he can go back to Rome and rebuild it. And there's this really great moment where Nico asks him, well, why don't you just film in Venice? And he said, well, because it's not Venice, it's Fellini's Venice. So it's a kind of hyper version of Venice that isn't real. And it speaks to the way in which everybody, I guess, in this book mediates things through art, through film, through image, including on that occasion, Nico himself, who's a bit like a Renaissance painting or a bit like somebody from Death in Venice, but is already also being seen through Fellini's eyes as well. So there are multiple layers to the way we see Nico at that moment, and none of them seem to be real.
Yes, but actually when Fellini sees Nico for the first time, he goes, oh, yes, but he's a Botticelli, but an English one.
Yes, always an English.
What does that mean?
Well, it's quite odd, isn't it? But he does seem oddly out of place, although he speaks Italian and seems himself to be relieved to be in Italy. He feels it's like coming home after going through France, which he didn't enjoy, and then he kind of gets to Italy and he feels at home.
And the flaming red hair.
And So although that isn't the only thing that we think, I think, about the relationship between Donati and Nico. It is kind of fragile and they kind of come back together, break up throughout the novel. But there is moments of real connection, and there's some really interesting moments that connect their relationship to kind of histories of gay life and also histories of European politics as well. So there's a kind of extraordinary moment where they're having sex and Donati has this really strange line, really, for kind of bedtime talk. So the first time someone did this for me, he tells Nicholas, who is already breathless, the Germans were in Florence and we lived like the mice between the walls. All of Donati's stories were like that, sly, spectacular, untrumpable. He licks with pleasure, totally focused on his prize. So it's kind of gloriously sensuous, but in amongst it, there's this kind of cutting idea of gay men having sex in hiding during Mussolini's Italy, hiding away from the fascist authorities. As the book moves on, that context becomes increasingly important, because the other film that we're dealing with is Pasolini's Salo, which he moves on to after completing Casanova.
And they both do, actually. Both, yes. Donati and Nico, who's now become his apprentice, assistant, gopher, everything, travels with him to that set, the new one.
That's right. And the new set for Salo is obviously haunted by the legacies of Mussolini's Italy, by the violence of the end games of fascist Italy.
Yeah, now we have to explain what that film is about. And, you know, this is only 20 years after the end of the war, so it's very fresh. And I was surprised, actually, by the exuberance that's described in this book of the Italian gay scene, although obviously cinema and that kind of crowd is where you would find it. But the Pasolini film is called Salo, the 120 Days of Sodom, which is based on the Marquis de Sade's famous book. And it has been described as the most horrifying film ever made.
That's right. And it's Pasolini's attempt to capture the horror that he lived through. In fact, Donati lived through as well in northern Italy during the dying days of Mussolini's regime, where he was held onto power with aid of the Germans, but only in a very small bit of Italy, who enacted extraordinary violence against the local population in northern Italy at that time. And it's about the legacies of that in the memories of these characters, but also in the political memory of Italy as well during the 1970s, which was going through a period of real violence. So it's Pasolini's attempt to kind of enter into political discourse around the horrors of the legacies of fascism in Italy, making him a kind of cause célèbre as well, and somebody that even before he's arrived in Italy, Nico has heard of, because when he was studying in the Slade, he says, the Slade, Pasolini was like a god, a sexy god. And so he's kind of primed to already kind of fall in love a little bit with Pasolini, and he clearly does have a crush on him when he meets him.
So these two great men of cinema, Donati and Pasolini, are both sexy, actually, in completely different ways. So Donati's he loves food and cooking, and he's messy and he's a little bit chubby, and he's just got his shirt undone a little bit too much. And I loved him. I thought he was great. And Pasolini is always wearing something very like extremely expensive Missoni shirt. And he has this silver Alfa Romeo, which just stunned the boys when he's out cruising. And there's a line that I just had to stop and I just loved it. The Alfa draws attention in the villages. Boys are drawn to it, emerging from houses, fields, like so many iron filings.
Oh, that is wonderful. And it really does describe, if you see pictures of Pasolini from this period, he's extraordinarily glamorous, but also often surrounded by rent boys, really, rough trade.
And many people will know that that's part of the end of his story, a very violent one and complex and conspiracy filled.
I think if you know the story of Pasolini, that Alfa Romeo is, it's a Chekhov's gun. So his end was violent. And Olivia Lang, the writer of this novel, is also an essayist, and they write on art and film, and their most recent essay in The Guardian was on the conspiracy theories that surround Pasolini's end, which they consider to be the result of conspiracy against him by neo-fascist organizations that had infiltrated the government alongside mafia elements as well. The novel circles around this without being explicit.
I so want to watch the films. I'm determined to seek out at least Casanova. And I'm also getting Grace Kelly vibes about the Alfa Romeo.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, funnily enough, Salo has been screening around the world in limited outlets.
Always attended by still a sense of outrage at its violent and, I guess, sexual nature, which kind of, when a film is doing that deliberately, when a film is doing that to sort of make a social point, seems such an unfair pigeonholing and criticism.
Well, it was banned around the world.
Yeah, and there's some sense that because Pasolini hadn't finished it, by the time that he was assassinated. There's some sense that his assassination was done deliberately to kind of lessen the impact of the film because of the way that he was killed. So he was killed by the rent boys that he picked up. And it's a way of saying, well, look, this was part of his life. So it kind of lessened the political impact of the film in deliberate ways is one of the theories that people have around that.
So this book, The Silver Book by Olivia Lang, is actually dedicated to Danilo Donati, but also in memory of Gary Indiana, who is a writer and critic, who she says wrote an essay extolling this film's, quote, still radioactivity capacity to wound the viewer. Like, it's still one of the landmarks, horrific as it may be, of cinema.
Yeah, and you know, it's pointed that Lang has produced this novel this year. I mean, they know what they're doing, guys.
Yes.
I'm envious that you got to read a real novel.
This is a great book. I just can't stop thinking about it. What about you, Hugh?
It's really wonderful. I've always liked Lang's essay writing. They are a wonderful writer on modern and contemporary art, particularly artists on the margins of society. Some really fantastic essays in their collection, Funny Weather. I would recommend that for sure. But this novel, yeah, it's just great. And I think we haven't even pointed out how funny some elements of it are. So in the filming of Casablanca, Fellini famously...
Oh, Casanova.
not Casablanca, it's a very different film. In the filming of Casanova in particular, Fellini, always known as a kind of very dictatorial kind of director, has really fallen out of love with both his film and the central character, and as a result really hates the actor playing the central character, Donald Sutherland, and subjects him to increasing torture by making his costume more and more uncomfortable and insulting him in Italian like right in front of his face, not realizing that Donald Sutherland can understand every single word that he says, because Donald Sutherland is pretending that he can't speak Italian, but he can. And so those scenes are really, really fantastic.
Yeah. Giant whales and huge feasts and quite hilarious things.
I want this book.
It is great.
I want this book too.
Yep. Well, it is called The Silver Book and it's by Olivia Lang. This is The Bookshelf. I'm Cassie McCullough here with Jonathan Green this
Hello.
Week. And our guests today, Hugh Griffiths and Claire Mabey. To another book with a famous name attached, and that is Jeanette Winterson, author of 15 novels, beginning with the semi-autobiographical Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit in 1985.
Gosh, it's a track record, isn't it? And here we have, and is it a novel? One Aladdin, Two Lamps. What is this book? In part, it's a retelling of the 1001 Nights. That's the story of how Scheherazade uses the power of story and the waterfall moments, which conclude chapters. It's to save her own life. The Sultan has been betrayed by one of his many wives, and as an act of revenge, he takes a new virgin to his bed each night and kills her in the morning. Scheherazade almost volunteers for this role and saves herself by telling tales. And in part, this book is an elaborate essayish musing on the power of story, and it's full of particular reflections on Winterson's own journey towards her settled sense of self, her own story. It's about what Winterson calls the sovereignty of the imagination, or, to quote her, stories know more than we do. It makes a case. It's in fact a sort of an essay with inclusions of a fictionalized retelling of Scheherazade, but it makes this case for the human capacity for story as a more powerfully defining quality than the human capacity for love.
Mm.
Claire, were you sort of stumped by what this was going to be as it began? Because it begins quite poetically.
Completely stumped. Ultimately, what I concluded was, I think Jeanette Winterson is trying to teach us how to read and how to think. It almost suggests it's self-help. It seems to me to come into this vein of book I've seen pop up a lot this year, which is books by artists on art and how they can help us think and live in this very, very changed world.
Hmm.
I just think it's a very idiosyncratic attempt at doing that.
But it's part of, I mean, yes, there is that thing towards self-help around the notion of art and creative process, but there's also this breaking down of the boundaries of genre, that a book need not be a thing, the book need not be a novel, or not, you know, that may not necessarily be what it appears to be. And as you begin this book, you're kind of struggling to see, is that voice fictional? You know, it's only when she sort of directly addresses herself and her own issues, you know, quite first personally, that you go, oh, okay, right, this is what you're doing.
Yeah, that's where we are. Yeah, and I have to say it took me quite a long time to get into the rhythm of this book. I was bamboozled at first. And even actually when she does kind of assume the voice of Shahrazad, there's a sense of Winterson tugging those stories into our time. So she does take liberties with the stories as she goes and kind of tugs them towards, I guess, archetypes and stereotypes that we have in our world, like tech bros, for example.
But I think her case is a really interesting one, that this idea that the great human capacity, the great human invention, the great human asset is this ability to tell a story. Mm. That is sort of a fundamental thing to our idea of having hope.
I think so. And I appreciated this focus on the imagination above love. I thought that was a very interesting and provocative thought. And also that I dog-eared almost every second page of this book, because there are so many
big thoughts all the time, aren't there?
All the time, and it's very kaleidoscopic. So it doesn't rest easily on anything. It kind of shifts and changes. I mean, I suppose she's trying to mirror that sense of nothing really ends. There's an ending as a beginning, and so on and so on. And she talks about...
Oh, you mean like the stories within...
Like the stories, yeah.
The Arabian Nights or the 1001 Nights. Because each story she tells has a little hook in the end.
Yes, and the Sultan wants more.
Then becomes the beginning of tomorrow's story. So she saves her life each
time. Exactly, she's saving life, she's preventing death. And in one moment in the book, Winterson talks about our lives are constant interruption now. And being inside a story, reading is the interruption to the interruption. And I really loved that return to the kind of concentrated imaginary work of reading, long form in particular. I really like that. Even though this book in itself is quite fast and erratic and moves very quickly from one thought to the next.
As much as it is full of those big and important thoughts, and as much as it is consistently beautifully expressed, it also, it kind of annoyed me. It felt like sort of unmediated writing you'd find on, and you would find this on, Jeanette Winterson's Substack.
Exactly.
It's sort of an internet book. It's that sort of flow of stuff which it's throwing stuff at the wall without necessarily that sort of unity and cohesion and editedness that one might expect from a proper book.
Exactly, and I actually went and looked at her Substack and saw that she'd printed the first part on
she
there
did,
already.
Yes.
I thought, oh yes,
this is what this is about.
Feel like internet writing. I feel like we've been let into Winterson's mind, and she will not let us rest.
But I think she's let go an opportunity. You know, I think there was a better construction that brought together these two ideas with, I'm going to use the word discipline, but it's not quite the right word, but a better sense of structural poise in this book that would have made more of its elements. It feels like I've had this great idea, and yes, there is something in what Shahrazad is doing that illuminates this notion of the importance of story, the importance of those created realities. But I think she could have woven more closely her thoughts around that. It feels erratic. It feels dumped into the page a little for me.
I do agree. And I think that she had the structure there. She had the 1001 Nights. You know, the structure was there, but it's very slippery in this book. And she swims away from it and then abruptly returns to it. But it is a book I think I will refer back to quite a bit, as I think these arguments are going to be made more and more often. But I think what annoyed me the most about this book was the AI conversation.
Oh, yes, which is another of her pet themes.
Yeah, but I found it incredibly concerning. So basically her thesis is that she wants and hopes AI will become conscious eventually because she thinks it will help us, humanity, reconsider what aliveness means, and that aliveness will not be attached to the material world because AI consciousness theoretically won't be interested in land grab and material wealth, etc., etc. But that didn't fly for me at all. I can't marry that theory.
Can I just ask about, like, when she's talking about story, and I love the idea of the power of story, and even just that word to me has my attention because I love to enter into a story. But she seems to have made her most groundbreaking work first, which is a curse in a way for a writer. Mm. Is she trapped in that story of hers in some way, or does this emerge in the book, the writing of her own life?
Oh, definitely.
Definitely.
We're both in huge agreement. Claire, why do you say that?
I mean, I think as soon as the book went to her childhood, I understood it. I was like, oh, Jeanette is still working out the impact.
It's very unsettled, isn't it?
Very unsettled, of being adopted, of growing up in an evangelical Christian household where books were not allowed and the imagination was tempered or really fueled in this hilarious way of judgment and everything will be fine because everyone else will be wiped out and will be okay.
We should just say for people who haven't read Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, that this is a coming out as a lesbian story, which is so completely shocking to the environment in which she grew up. So that's this moment in her life you seem to be saying that she keeps returning to, and it's still alive for her.
Still alive. And I think because for her, reading, and she says this in this book, reading was a way to cultivate her imagination and rewrite her story because she is the story, so she could retell it herself. You know, she could prevent death, so to speak, of her own self by getting a better story.
That she escapes in part through reading, in part through reading 1001 Nights. This is a key thing that she discovers in a library that is central to her development as a person and around her idea of story and its potential. So it's, which is another way in which this is such a beautiful thing here, that its potential is not fulfilled in this book. That I find, as much as the seeds are there, the glimmers are there of what it might have been, the finished result is a little too loose and erratic.
Yeah, I think I agree. It feels like she is drawing upon an absolute lifetime of reading, and she has built such an incredible wealth of connections and ideas and opinions, and it's all just been let loose.
That's One Aladdin, Two Lamps by Jeanette Widdowson. That's published by Penguin Random House.
Well, fantastic reading. Thank you both to Claire Mabey and Hugh Griffiths for being our reviewers today. Before we part company, let's get a couple of recommendations. Hugh, what would you like to recommend?
Well, it's coming to the end of the year, so I was thinking about what my favourite novel that I've read through this year, new novel that I've read through this year.
You mean The Silver Book?
Besides the Silver Book, actually, maybe Beside the Silver Book, because it really was fantastic. Sean Hewitt's novel, Open Heaven. Like the other writers we've been talking about today, Hewitt's kind of multi-talented. He's a poet, he's a scholar, a memoirist. His memoir, All Down Darkness Wide, is really fantastic. But his novel, Open Heaven, came out earlier this year. In some ways, a really straightforward gay coming-of-age story, a 16-year-old, lost, awkward James living in a kind of small village, dreaming of somewhere else, and lo and behold, a kind of glamorous stranger arrives in the fob along from him, and he kind of falls for him, really. But that straightforward story isn't really what attracted me to it. It's really the way that Hewitt describes the location that this takes place in, which is a peculiarly, I think, British location. Maybe it reminded me of places where I grew up. And it's on the margins of small towns, these small villages, surrounded by fields, but also by motorway overpasses, this kind of weird mixture of the rural and the urban that we get in the kind of overcrowded countryside. And the way that this space in Britain can be really a place for imagination and transformation, a kind of in-between space where you can reimagine yourself, but you're also somehow trapped by it as well. And Hewitt is just fantastic at describing those spaces. And so what is a fairly straightforward, if you just describe the plot, coming-of-age story becomes something much richer and much stranger. And I just really loved it.
Interesting. Now, we did actually review that book on the bookshelf in June with Steve Minon. People might remember that or might want to go back to it.
ABC Listen App is your friend.
That's right.
Claire, what have you been reading across the ditch?
Well, across the ditch here, I have been reading The Rose Field by Philip Pullman. So the final in the Book of Dust trilogy that brings Lyra Silvertongue's story to a close. So a really monumental moment, I think, in publishing, especially for us millennials who kind of grew up with Lyra's story in the His Dark Materials trilogy, which came first. And I honestly had such mixed feelings.
Does that leave a bit of an emptiness when that finishes?
I didn't want to start the book because I didn't want to finish the book. And that world meant so much to me and really shaped me a lot, I think, as a writer of fantasy. So it was confronting to read for that reason alone. But then I don't think it is entirely successful conclusion.
I was
disappointed. But on the other hand, I think it will be a book I will be thinking about and debating with myself about for a very long time. So really, and it's very interesting to read it actually against Jeanette Winterson, because Pullman's concern is very much with the imagination. I think he is very concerned that our world is losing it. And we are beholden to the dull concerns of capitalism. And really, that's what the novel is about. Mm. So it's a really confronting and interesting novel. I think it's hard to read as an adult because it feels so adult, whereas you want to return to that magic of childhood. So it's a really very interesting book. And I think part of the disappointment is it's about the loss of magic.
Well, this is tough news to hear as a completist of the His Dark Materials trilogy and the first two in this trilogy, which I did love a lot.
Mm.
So I'll see what I think. Claire, I also think you have read a book which is in Jonathan's wheelhouse as the presenter of Every Bite.
Oh, bring me the food content.
This is a book on food culture.
Yeah, I absolutely love Ruby Tando as a writer. So she was on the Great British Bake Off in 2013 and since then has become a kind of cookbook writer and a brilliant essayist on food culture. But her book, All Consuming, Why We Eat the Way We Eat Now, is just an absolutely stunning collection of essays on contemporary food culture. So she looks at things like bubble tea and the phenomenon. She looks at things like allrecipes.com, that culture of sharing recipes and what it means for the way we cook and what it means for cookbook culture. She explores supermarkets. She explores kind of iconic cookbooks. Her essays are very enjoyable, very funny, sharp intelligence all the way through. She's really pushing, asking questions, coming to very interesting conclusions, and really shining a light on things that I think we probably don't look at very hard in our everyday life.
And that's an element of the culture, yes, that we take so much for granted, but is so powerful and needs that sort of analysis. Don't forget, you know, we're talking books, the biggest books in our world, they're about food.
Mm. Yeah.
Without exception. So much to talk about in that.
Well, you had me at supermarkets. I could talk about them ad nauseum. I think they're fascinating. All right, well, that sounds great and a rare thing indeed, a reality television person crossing over into literary essays.
Isn't that great?
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
All right, Ruby Tando's All Consuming. Hey, Claire, Hugh, thanks so much. It's been great fun reading with you both today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Associate Professor Hugh Griffiths is with the School of English and Writing at the University of Sydney, and Claire Mabey is the founder of New Zealand's literary festival, Verb Wellington, and she's also a critic and the author of The Raven's Eye Runaways, which is a children's book, Jonathan.
It's a middle grade children's book, Cassie.
Yes, indeed. Well, next time on The Bookshelf, Kate Evans will be back, and we're looking at some new collections of short stories, including one by Salman Rushdie, and also we'll get a roundup of crime from our crime-loving reviewers Sue Turnbull and Johan Gabrielsen, who's reading the latest in the Lisbeth Salander series. But bye for now, and see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.